Today is Saturday, June 13th, 2020. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee, spelled F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Well, good, Tom. Thanks.
Great.
Happy Coronavirus Day to you.
Oh, is it?
Well, I don't know what it is.
The Pandemic Day. Yeah.
Pandemic.
Yeah. Happy Fires All Around Us Day. May we have your permission to record this oral history interview over the phone?
You may.
Thank you very much.
What would you say if I said no?
I would say, well, then I guess we won't record it. I'll turn the machine off and take notes. yeah, that's what I would do. So we finished off part 5 when you were just transitioning from roughly a day short of a year in Death Valley.
Right.
And transitioned over to Yosemite. And a year before, roughly a year before you arrived, a rather interesting event happened in Yosemite called the Yosemite Riots. Can you take us back to what led up to the riots, and then the riot itself, and then kind of what happened afterwards?
Well, okay. Well, you know, there's probably a lot of things that took place that led up to the riot, and it's, you know, riot is almost a little misnomer. Sometimes I refer to it as the Stoneman Meadow Massacre, which fortunately nobody was massacred. You know, nobody died. But, you know, that period of time from the late maybe 66, 67 era up to 73 or 4 was the counterculture period in this country's history. And it was more than just hippies, but there were hippies as well. And hippies is sort of a generalized term, which would include the counterculture. But, you know, you had Vietnam going on. You had a lot of racial tensions going on. You had the women's movement. You know, things like Kent State took place not long before that. Woodstock was in there. There was a whole different atmosphere around this country. You know, Black Panthers, the underground, the Weathermen, the Chicago 7, I guess it is. So there was a lot of turmoil, social turmoil around the country. And Yosemite, because, well, let me backtrack for just a moment. There were, you know, involved. Not that everybody was using drugs, but there was a fair amount of LSD. I guess, you know, Timothy Leary was part of that. The, you know, a lot of marijuana. So Yosemite was sort of a crossroads for, on a micro scale anyway, crossroads for this whole social movement. And but you also had in the park, you had a lot of, hold on. I don't know why I'm having trouble. Every time I start talking anymore, these last couple of months, this sort of happens, I guess.
No worries.
But, you know, also in the park, though, you had, you know, a lot of family groups, and for lack of a better term, sort of the straights, you know, versus the others. And, so there was always that sort of clash, and sometimes it was a big deal, sometimes it wasn't. But in Berkeley, there was Berkeley and Stanford and, you know, the San Francisco area in general. There was a lot of underground, you know, the social turmoil. So there were several underground newspapers. One that I can recall very distinctly is called the Berkeley Barb. And I don't know that it's still, in, you know, being done, probably not. But it would talk about the Rangers in Yosemite as an example and name them and put photos of them in this Berkeley Barb. And on one occasion, several weeks before, there was an announcement put into some of these underground newspapers, and then just word of mouth, because the social media that we have today didn't exist then. And you know, come to Yosemite, we're going to take the valley over, or maybe or the park over. I'm not sure. And so there, in addition to the normal group of hippies, if you will, that were hiding in the caves and camping and, you know, living in the valley, you know, a lot of others showed up as well. And the Park Service, you know, the rangers and the park management really had no ability to handle this stuff. There was no real perspective. The park managers at the time were sort of old school, you know, older white guys, probably in their 50s and 60s at this point, and had, you know, this whole culture, the drugs and the long hair and
the establishment?
I was thinking about sort of the sexual revolution is what I was thinking about, and I couldn't get that out.
Okay.
Properly. But yeah, they represented the establishment.
Okay.
And
hey, Butch.
Yes.
I want to go back a minute. I've been thinking about something you said about the Berkeley Barb.
Yeah.
And that it had photos of rangers in it. What was it saying about the Park Service in Yosemite?
Well, I think that, the rangers in those days, and several of them are still very good friends of mine,
mm-hmm.
you know, had no real training in law enforcement or crowd control or crowd management.
All right.
And, weren't really tuned in. They're very empathetic and nice people and gave, you know, good interpretive programs and that sort of thing. They weren't necessarily, because of the training or lack thereof, actually. They were sort of hardcore, and I think there was, in many cases, they were forced into it. There'd be overwhelming numbers in campsites and a lot of theft from, the neighboring campsites, and it was really a zoo. And these guys, not only did they have to put up and deal with the law enforcement stuff, but they also put up with the climbing, which was just beginning, which hadn't been in the park too long, trying to figure out how to get somebody off of these big walls now when, you know, the rangers, with one or two exceptions, really had no either interest or ability to learn how to climb. And, you know, climbing is a specialty. You have to have some willingness to do some of these big walls like El Cap and Half Dome. So, you know, plus they were doing the EMS and fire. I mean, they were, you know, rangers were doing everything, which is what I enjoyed. That's what I did for 10 years there in Yosemite.
Mm-hmm.
But the rangers were a little hard-ass sometimes, I suspect, or at least they were interpreted as that. And so in the Berkeley Barb, at least one or several of these men, because we didn't have any women at that time, were featured, or at least their faces were put on and photos of them. And, and beyond that, I really don't have any firsthand knowledge of these articles. I know that they took place. But frankly, I've never seen one.
Okay.
So whether I'm actually telling a lie here or not, I don't know. But I've been told that that's what was taking place.
Well, it's funny because I was just thinking about, you know, the national parks as a place of refuge. And so it would make sense that people in San Francisco and Berkeley would look to the park, basically an extension of you know, their backyard, not too, a ways out of town, but you know, sort of off to the east there in the Sierras. So it's not a place, I guess you would think, or at least I would think as a naive kind of guy, that there would be this clash of old school, new school values. But that was happening everywhere. It was happening in town. It was happening out of town. It was happening all across the country. So there's no reason to suspect that it shouldn't have been happening with the National Park Service.
Yeah. Well, in these big parks, particularly like Yosemite and Death Valley and other parks, you know, oftentimes during that era, people sort of thought it was a free-for-all. You know, once they got into the park and they're in a Disneyland kind of an environment, anything goes, a lot of nudism. You know, it was just people sort of left their brains at the gate when they came in. So, but you also had, you know, family groups and the straits, if you will, as I said before, you know, camping there as well. And there was always these clashes, and it wasn't like it was an everyday fistfight, but there was friction between the groups often. And
groups of, like, people with loud music or partying or nudity, that kind of stuff that the straits, if you will, I think of Ozzy and Harriet, would have trouble with and wouldn't necessarily want to camp next to. Is that kind of right there?
Well, yeah. I mean, and they often had to, you know, camp next to each other. And again, there was everyday friction, but it wasn't friction between every campsite or anything. It wasn't that egregious.
Okay.
But it was, you go down to the market, you go to Degnan's, which was a little delicatessen there, and there'd be these, 16 to 25-year-olds just hanging out. Some were panhandling, begging food, not food so much, but money, as people would walk by, which, you know, we had trying to curtail that. We would have undercover rangers trying to watch for it, that sort of thing. So it wasn't like we were ignoring it. It's just that there was so much of this that it was one emergency after another or one incident after another. And, in front of the village store or Degnan's, which was the delicatessen, and all through the mall. And in those days, you could drive into the mall. It was a big parking lot. Now it's sealed off, and it's a walking mall, and they've done a lot of work to it since, putting in trees and that sort of thing. But, you know, 1970, you could drive in there, and loud music, as you say, and in the campgrounds, the campsites, there'd be partying at night, and, the family groups were trying to get the kids to sleep, and the kids were exposed to naked girls and probably or at least half-dressed and half-dressed men or boys. So it was really quite exciting from my perspective, quite interesting. And I think way back, a couple of sessions back, I mentioned that, a lot of my peers were really felt that their forte was to take care of the resource. And I certainly don't want to denigrate that, but I sort of thought my forte might be working with the public in these kinds of situations, because a lot of my peers were taking care of the rest of the resource. So
okay.
That's sort of my perspective on it. So I've already lost your question, Tom. I got to running off at the mouth here.
No worries. What I was... You know, we were talking about the clash of cultures, the hippies, if you will, the new wave, the new progressives, and the straights, the people later on in years, and you know, sort of the typical American culture And one of the things that occurred to me was that the Park Service had no management plan per se. This was before management plans. Is that right?
Well, I guess I can't speak to exactly that. The park, Yosemite, and I guess the Park Service in general, just was unprepared. You know, they, to some degree, we had our heads in the sand.
It sounds like unprepared, not just for the clash of cultures, but for the growth of visitation.
Right, yeah. And,
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's the Straits camped next to the hippies, in a number of campsites, and people are panhandling. What led up to the events then of June 21st? It wasn't June 21st, 1970. It was what was the day in 19 June 11th? Nope.
Well, July 4th was the.
Was it July 4th?
It was the 4th of July weekend. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's the riot. Now there are a lot of things that led up to that point.
Like what?
Well, one was the Memorial Day weekend. You know, it was sort of a trial run. There were a lot of people in the park. And, any of these big parks, of course, the major weekends, like the Memorial Day, Labor Day, 4th, are very busy anyway,
mm-hmm.
to the point where the park is breaking at the seams. And, you know, the rangers and the staff in general are working sort of 24/7 sometimes.
Right.
I mean, it's really... You know, at the end of an eight-hour shift, you just don't go home. I mean, there's still so much going on. And in my case, I would come back and work 16, 18 hours a day.
Okay.
Which, of course, led up to my divorce eventually, right? But, there was just so much going on. But the weekend before Memorial, not weekend, but the big weekend before, Memorial Day weekend, lots of people... And everybody seemed to get along pretty good. There were instances of people being arrested, of course. The jail that we had in the park at that time that weekend was capable of holding about 8 people. So... the rangers were stressed at that point. Well, a lot of these people came back the 4th of July, but what they didn't know about or didn't expect anyway was that the Berkeley Barb and some of these other underground newspapers and just the, word of mouth, come up to Yosemite, we're going to take the park. And that's what they tried to do. And I don't think anybody really thought that they were going to wrestle away from the federal government. But mm-hmm. I do think, though, that a lot of these younger people just thought this is a big party. And, we're going to raise some cane and we'll see what happens. So the park was instituting a closure of this one particular meadow called Stoneman Meadow, which is a pretty good sized meadow, and it's between the Awani Hotel and the Curry Village grocery store or the complex there. And actually, I'm wrong on that, Tom. I was thinking about the Awani Meadow. The Stoneman Meadow is over closer to the campgrounds. But again, a very good-sized meadow, I think even bigger. So they put signs up saying the meadow's going to be closed at 7 o'clock because there was so much impact to the vegetation and just the resource in general, and that was the color under which the park was trying to enforce this closure. So these signs were put up. Well, you could almost envision what's going to happen. The park had about 15 patrol rangers, the park superintendent, or maybe the acting superintendent at that time, called the company wrangler, the guy in charge of the wrangler, a guy by the name of Dean. Forgot Dean's last name. But to bring his wranglers and horses over, and the park had a couple of mounted patrolmen as well. So they were all sort of hidden out in the trees. I think it was Pete Thompson got on a bullhorn and said, okay, the meadow is closed, because it was like 7 o'clock at night, and there are probably, I think a good guesstimate would be maybe 600 young people in this meadow waiting for this event to take place. And a lot of drinking. Some of them have stockpiled rocks behind trees. They put bottles behind trees in order to throw and break. There are photos, actually, of horses having the bottles being broken over the noses of horses. So the meadow is closed at 7 o'clock. Well, it becomes a big rout. You know, the rangers go out, the wranglers go out. I'm sure that, people were stepped on by some of the horses. Well, at the end of the hour or so, it was sort of hippies 1, rangers 0. They were thrown out of the meadow. And the meadow was basically taken over by this group of counterculture people that were trying to make a statement of some kind. So what happened at that point is the dispatcher for the park, I think it was Ann Means, put out a call to other agencies, and exactly the mechanism for doing that I'm not clear about, but she was able to send out a message that was picked up by several local sheriff's departments, Mariposa County, Merced County, Madera County, as well as the California Highway Patrol, the Border Patrol, the FBI, U.S. Marshals. And ultimately what happens within the next 3 hours, you've got someplace close to 150 to 175 outside law enforcement officers come rushing into the park to assist the rangers, because the rangers, the way she put out this message was that the valley is being overridden, taken over. So you've got all of these policemen and sheriff's deputies and some highway patrolmen and some FBI agents from Merced, and all these people rushing up into the park, none of which, except for the FBI, none of which had any legal jurisdiction in the park. Technically, they couldn't do any law enforcement, which probably wouldn't have stopped them anyway, but the U.S. Marshal, I think the assistant to the state U.S. Marshal, and I'm not sure if that's not the technical term, but the U.S. Marshal's office anyway came up and deputized all of these non-federal officers, like sheriff's deputies and policemen from Merced, policemen from Fresno, deputized them and made them agents of the federal government. So now technically they could make these arrests. And ultimately what happens, well, let me backtrack for a moment. So a couple of cars are burned. One sheriff's car is rolled over and torched. There are shots fired, but I think they were warning shots. I don't necessarily think it was anybody shooting at anybody else. It was just a real melee, I guess is a good word, which I don't very often use, I suppose. But it, it was a real rout for the Rangers and the, initially. And then you got all these outside policemen, law enforcement people coming in. So now they end up during the night, you know, the next 5 or 6 hours, you end up having, again, something like, I've seen the figure, it 169 rings in my mind, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But, you know, let's say at least 160 people were arrested. They had mass arrests, buses that were brought up from Fresno, at least, for just this kind of thing, and that was sort of the, you know, climate that was taking place around the entire country. You know, there were all these kinds of skirmishes and incidents where there would be a lot of people, demonstrations, you know, where people were being arrested, but in mass. And an officer would take somebody, have his photograph taken with whoever is being arrested, turn them over. The person being arrested would be turned over to somebody who would have them restrained or handcuffed and probably in one of these buses. And they end up going down to Fresno, where they are booked. Now, ultimately, most of these people are released. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look at some of the documents, I guess, but to see if anybody was really held for any length of time. But I think it would have been, it was really a way to sort of control the situation. And yes, they were probably arrested, but they were also released. And, you know, I think a good lawyer and probably the U.S. Attorney's Office or whatever probably could get in and dissect this and see how, what was legal and what wasn't legal. But, just for the grace of goodness, I guess, nobody was hurt, seriously hurt. Dr. Wardler, who both Tom and I know, and I still have on a pedestal, who just recently died in, within the last 6 months or so, was a doctor. He was trained, he was a surgeon by training, but had spent time in Vietnam and had been working in a MASH unit in Vietnam at that time, and he was used to this kind of thing. And he told me on several different occasions, he said, you know, it was his opinion that one wrong move, and this could have been a Kent State, it could have been, you know, some ranger that got scared or some higher, not so much higher patrol, but probably some sheriff's deputy that might not have had very much training, would get spooked, and bam, before you know it, you've got people killed or seriously hurt. And although people were injured, nobody was seriously hurt. I don't think anybody was really taken to the hospital for any long time anyway. They might have been treated. So that took place all night. And the next morning, there's actually a movie, or not a movie, but a video of much of this, I use it to teach with, that was taken by a young man at the time, by David Vassar, V-A-S-S-A-R, who went on to be quite a pretty significant cinematographer, making lots of movies, certainly for the Park Service included. So, but they, you know, the next weekend, within a couple of days, the U.S. Park Police in D.C. brought in a contingent of park policemen, and they were way out of their element. I mean, you know, the park needed some manpower, but they didn't know anything about being around bears or providing advanced first aid, responding to emergencies other than law enforcement. But it was still good to have, you know, this backup there. That was the time exactly when the first, or at least the second group of rangers were at a police school going through formal police training in Washington, D.C. They were brought back to augment what was taking place in the park, being a lack of manpower. So, you know, all of a sudden, this was a serious social milestone in National Park Service history. Not only from law enforcement, but all of a sudden, the establishment, the old guard ranger, old guard managers, sort of were woken up, or were finally awakened by the fact that, you know, the country is moving on, and there's a different clientele coming into the parks, that they couldn't manage these places like they used to in the 40s or the 50s. I mean, you know, life had moved on, and lots of things were taking place socially around the country that the Park Service just needed to catch up to, and at that point was way behind what was, you know, what was taking place in the rest of the country. So I'm going to shut up for a second, Tom, and see if you got any questions, because I've been shooting my mouth off here a lot.
Well, I only have one right away, which was, do you know the name of the superintendent?
Larry Hadley was the superintendent. He was not in the park at the time. That's H-A-D-L-E-Y. And
what do you know about Larry?
Well, not really too much.
Okay.
I mean, I have ways to double check that, but I don't know much off the top of my head.
Okay, no worries. And you mentioned that Dick Marks, M-A-R-K-S, was the staff park ranger. What was Dick's role in all this? Do you know?
Yeah, let me hold on just a second. I'm going to grab a book.
Okay.
It'll only take me about 30 seconds.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you.
And the book is the historic listing of National Park Service officials.
Hmm.
And in it, I'm going to go to Yosemite. If I can remember where exactly Y is in the alphabet here.
In the back somewhere.
Yeah. U-Z-W-X-Y. Okay, Z. So, Yosemite. And what I'm looking up is... let's see what it says here. So, Hadley was the superintendent in Yosemite from January 28, 1968... to August 22, 1970.
Hmm.
And that date is not that date per se, but that is a pretty important mention, because Mr. Hadley, number of his, not only Hadley, but a couple of others. This was such a black eye for the Park Service, and you know that George Hartzog, who was then the director, removed him. He was taken out of that position. And you had mentioned Dick Marks, and we had talked about him before. Dick was the staff park ranger, which. I've never seen his position description, but he had his finger in protection kinds of things, fire, law enforcement, search and rescue, but he didn't necessarily supervise too much. The people that were in charge of fire and other things were part of this FOST, this unit manager system. That was sort of dispersed. You know, you had rangers and interpreters in the valley working for one person, then the rangers and interpreters at Wawota were working for somebody else.
Where? I'm sorry, what was the second place?
Well, Wawota.
How do you spell that?
Yeah, W-A-W-O-N-A is the second most popular part of Yosemite National Park.
W-A-W-O-N-A.
Wawona.
Wawona. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Wawona. And I don't, I think there were maybe three unit managers at that time, and Brian Harry, B-R-Y-A-N-H-A-R-R-Y, was the valley. But Dick Marks was the staff park ranger, and at the time, he was probably the ranking, if you will, in terms of the GS level, the ranking person in the park, or at least at that spot in the meadow at that particular time. And I have to be careful here about speaking too ill of the dead, but the men that were there, the rangers that were there, tend to say that Dick was very unorganized and did not respond to this incident appropriately. And I think in defense of Dick, of course, maybe nobody could have. I mean, I don't, it would have been nice had we been able to foresee this. And probably some of the rangers did see it coming, but Dick is usually castigated, if that's the right term, for having created much of this turmoil.
How so?
Well, I mean, just his management style. He, when we talk about the Grand Canyon, and again, I want to be a little careful about
negative. Butch, one of the things I think of, you mentioned when you showed up at Yosemite, and suddenly you were overseeing, I don't know, a couple dozen people. You had no training for that.
No.
So I think of Dick, Dick Marks, and I'm assuming he had no training either, but that's an assumption.
Well, you know, I have to think about this a little bit, what Dick's history was before that. You know, I should know this too, Tom, because I worked directly for him he was my immediate supervisor both at the Grand Canyon, and then when I was superintendent at Padre Island, he was my immediate boss. So I should know more than I'm saying, and it's not that I have a real bad memory. Somehow I'm not so sure I ever really knew what his history was before that, but I would say that he didn't have much more training than anybody else did in terms of crowd management and these kinds of emergencies.
Okay.
You know, it's one thing to try to rescue somebody that's caught in the middle of the river or fight a wildland fire. It's another thing when you're trying to deal with 400, 500, 600 people who don't want to be corralled. I guess that's not even a good term, but, you know, that don't want to be managed, you know, there's a whole different set of skills and training and things that will lead up to somebody being able to do that.
Right. And my assumption, again, thinking about you and your career, those 3 years in the Tucson Police Department, you would have at least been familiar with large crowd control through the parade and, you know, the big events that were happening in Tucson. And I'm assuming that Dick Marks had none of that background. It's assumption on my part. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, I have to assume that Dick had some experience. I mean, he was, he was probably 8 to 10 years older than myself.
So mid-30s.
Mid-30s, late-30s.
Okay.
And, you know, my experience with crowd control, the middle, maybe 67, 68 era, when it became, policemen were being trained in crowd control and riot control. And, you know, I was put through the paces with a baton and my helmet on the police department. And we had some of that. But, you know, the rangers and the park staff and park staffs in general throughout the NPS hadn't got to this point, at least not that I recall. I mean, I was stuck in the middle of nowhere in Death Valley prior to this, so, you know, I'm not necessarily an expert on all of this. But Dick was a nice person, a good family man, but I think was just outgunned, sort of quote-unquote, you know, on that particular incident. So, as I say, you know, the men that were there, that were responding, that were out in the meadow confronting these counterculture types that, you know, with all the mace and the smoke and all kinds of stuff that was taking place up around them, they tend to say that Dick created this problem. And I suspect they can articulate that better than I can, just because they were there, nothing else. You know, in this case, it's sort of hearsay on my part, but it's a lot of hearsay. It's all saying the same thing.
Right.
So.
So you mentioned Larry Hadley, the superintendent at the time, within a month and a half, was transferred. Did Dick get transferred out as well? Did others get transferred out?
You know, surprisingly, Dick did not. Dick, I don't know why or how, but Dick was not put out. He wasn't transferred. He ended up not too long after that becoming the superintendent at Fire Island. But not because of anything he did on that particular weekend. It was just sort of his time to go.
Okay.
Surprisingly, though, others did, and Hadley was the one. And, of course, you know, the buck sort of stops at the top, as they say.
Yeah.
And Mr. Hadley was the superintendent at the time. And whether he should have been more prepared or, you know, could have been more prepared by seeing what happened in the administration before him, I don't know. We can always, you know, Monday morning quarterback and say yes, but the truth is a lot of these things just happen, and, you know, we should have been prepared, but we weren't, and maybe it's nobody's real fault. Maybe it's just the agency's fault.
Well, it's difficult to go into a crowd of people on horseback with a bunch of wranglers and expect to achieve success.
Well, yeah, and, you know, the truth is, up until in 2004, I think it was 2004, this other woman and I, Kim Tucker, and I pretty much single-handedly had a reunion in Yosemite Valley of people who worked or played or climbed or were even arrested. We didn't really care. During the 70s, that was a reunion.
Okay. And,
at the height of the reunion, we had probably close to 400 people that came.
Wow.
And a lot of friends, a lot of people I hadn't seen for years and years and years. But part of the agenda, I orchestrated a panel discussion, a 90-minute panel discussion. I got, at the time, the man was Bob Barbee, was his name, B-A-R-B-E-E, who, I think was actually, he might have even at that time been the regional director for Alaska, but he had been the superintendent in Yellowstone at one time, and was a very senior manager in the entire national park system. But he had been right there in the middle of that riot. He was a resource manager at the time. And he told me, and I'll come back to this panel in just a second, but he told me that he and another hiding behind a pine tree when all hell was breaking loose. And they were hiding behind this big pine tree with basically a hippie who turns out to be a former retired ex-policeman who doesn't want to be, I mean, he knows what's coming. He doesn't want to be out in the middle of it, but he was sort of there to help support everybody as well. And he ends up giving a bunch of love beads to give to Bob. Bob took off his Park Service shirt, so he had a T-shirt on. He's got these love beads on, so he would more fit into the the people that were around him. I mean, that's how scary that was. And then, so coming back to this panel, and I'll get back to the Wranglers. That's how I'm going to get to the Wranglers in just a second. So we had this panel, 90 minutes. Bob was the MC. And on stage were about five people who had been right in the middle of this riot. Pete Thompson, Dave Patterson, Ron Mackey, that's M-A-C-K-I-E, this Dean Wrangler that I feel embarrassed. I can't remember his last name at the moment. But he was the chief wrangler, ran the stock operation for the company, for the Curry Company. And then, as luck would have it, just by total coincidence, Dave Vassar, V-A-S-S-A-R, who had made this video, which is, you could find on YouTube, is really quite famous in certain circles anyway. And I've got all of them on the stage at one time. And there were probably 250 to 300 people in the auditorium. It was standing room only. Probably the fire marshal would have been really upset. And so Bob was able to have these men talk about what was taking place and what their part of the incident was, et cetera, et cetera. And he gets to Dean, the Wrangler, and this was all brand new information to me. This is 2004, I believe. Dean is saying that either the acting superintendent, and I don't know who that is, I could probably find out, but at the moment I can't tell you, called the concessions horse operation and basically said, bring all your wranglers and as many horses as you can. So these guys show up with and they're given axe handles. They've got fire helmets on. They're riding company horses. They're not deputized, or they have absolutely zero authority. They have as much training as the rest of the Rangers, which is basically none. And they are part of what's going out into the meadow. And this video that Dave Vassar was taking will show these guys out there with lariats and trying to, I don't know, wrangle people. I mean, I guess I don't have a good way to phrase that. It was a zoo, and the riot would be close to being correct, but the ranger part of this operation was so overwhelmed by manpower and the other side that, as I said, it was hippies one, rangers zero.
But well,
these rocks that I had said were stockpiled were being thrown. Wine bottles were being broken over the noses of horses. And this went on for probably, I'm going to try not to exaggerate, but probably half an hour to an hour these things were taking place. Mace was being sprayed. And the video will show you, a lot of the sort of smoke in the air around. I don't think it was necessarily smoke from campfires. It somehow there were firecrackers and other ways to produce smoke. It was pretty surreal. And the video will show a lot of this. So, you know, some of this is being validated by this video.
Yeah.
So did I get off of point here too far?
No, no, not at all. Again, I was just thinking, you know, you mentioned Hippies 1, Rangers 0, but that was only at the end of the first quarter, and the game ended at halftime. When Superior Firepower came in. But again, it's, you know, it's funny because no other, if I have this right, no other service unit in the agency had anything like this happen.
No, certainly not like this. But there had been some warning signs taking place over the previous year or two. You know, I mentioned one or two sessions back about that ranger killing that young boy in Lake Mead.
Right.
Lamoureux was the name of the ranger. And, you know, he wasn't trained. He wasn't prepared for what he was being asked to do, really. Although that's the way we conducted business for years and years and years, even during my time. You know, we had a lot of people working seasonally who had very little training. What training they got was mostly, you know, a day or two worth when they got up to the park. So there were these warning signs going on around the system, I'm sure. But Yosemite was the... there's probably a good word, you know, was the epitome at that point, anyway, of this sort of unrest, social unrest, the counterculture versus the straits, the park service management, old school, sort of being brought into the next century in terms of what's taking place around the country. You know, the park service has, in those days, certainly, and maybe even to today, but in those days, there was a lot of insular nature. You know, if you're in a national park in Yosemite Valley, and just, well, I guess example of me being in Death Valley, I really had no idea what was going on around me. And in my case, my defense is that I didn't have TV or radio. So I really wasn't sure what was taking place. Although while I was in the police department, I started seeing some of that.
But there were no, there wasn't a riot in Death Valley or
no.
at Lake Mead or at Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, Grand
no.
Canyon National Park, or a Statue of Liberty or Shenandoah.
Well, not necessarily riots, but there were incidents being, taking place around the country in national park areas.
Okay.
So not the magnitude that we're talking about right now.
Right.
Yeah, they're there.
So what was the outcome of this? What was the after incident review, if you will, of this? You know, what happened?
Well, before I leave the riot itself, let me tell you about one incident that took place that I just thought was hilarious.
Okay.
But
please.
Pretty significant, actually. And this was something I learned afterwards, but I was still in Yosemite at the time, probably about 1978, 79. And the chief law enforcement officer, Lee Shackleton, and I went down, for whatever reason, to see the sheriff in Mariposa, which is the county. Yosemite has three counties, and Mariposa is the principal one. But Mariposa, of course, is its own little county in the little town of Mariposa. So we went down to visit the sheriff for some reason, and he was telling the story, good old boy kinds of stories, that when he responded to that incident, he had a guy in jail who had stolen a cow. So he was a felon, cattle thief. But, as these small towns probably are prone to do, you know, everybody sort of knows everybody, and it's one of those things where he was, you know, let out to go work during the day and probably had to come back and, you know, shut the door when he went into his cell at night.
Yeah, of his own cell, right.
Sort of the Andy Griffith and Barney Fife time. So he gets this alert, and he takes this prisoner, and the two of them race up into Yosemite Valley. Now, he must have known this guy, and I don't know what his name is. But so they get into the valley, and pretty soon the marshal's office, the U.S. Marshal's office, is deputizing all of these outside entities. So conceptually, you've got a line of highway patrol, sheriff's deputies, some policemen standing on the line. And you've got this U.S. Marshal standing out in front, and, you know, raise your right hand. And they're sworn in as, you know, federal agents. And in this line is this felon, good old boy, friend of the sheriff. So now you've got this guy who was in jail for having stolen a cow, which would be a felony, being deputized as a federal agent, federal law enforcement agent, and he has a shotgun. So, and they're out, and it's actually, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it's the sheriff's car is one of the cars that's either turned over or is burned. Now, as I say, nobody was shot, fortunately, but I just thought it was not only funny, but pretty interesting about how chaotic things were at that particular moment when you've got this felon being sworn in as a federal law enforcement officer.
Right.
So that was my story about that. So your question about... What was your question?
Well, after action. You know, it's fascinating. It seems that when the dispatcher put out the call, the surrounding resources came with the kitchen sink. I mean, with the felon out of the jail and anybody else they could grab.
Right.
And they didn't give them axe handles and lariats. They gave them shotguns.
Well, I think the sheriff's deputy, the sheriff at that point, this was the sheriff, it wasn't the deputy, it was the, you know, number one guy.
Right.
For the county.
Yeah.
But in the park, you know, the park did not have a stash of any kind of weapons. You know, rangers before this were, you know, making car stops, and I think we talked about the day when, on day patrol, you really didn't wear a gun. You did not have a gun visible, at least.
Right.
At night, it was a little different story. You could have a weapon on, and you could have a pair of handcuffs. But that was about it. I mean, you really didn't have much. So when these guys, like the Wranglers and probably some maintenance men, were pushed into responding to what was taking place in the meadow itself. Some of them had axe handles. You know, they probably had other things I just don't know about. But the after-action aspect of this is somewhere around 160 people were arrested. I kind of think that, technically they were arrested, but I also believe that, you know, they probably were released by a magistrate in Fresno. So nobody did any kind of time or fines or anything. But from a management standpoint, the superintendent and several of his close administrators were removed from the park. The director, George Hartzog, who was an attorney by education, but had been in the park as a superintendent and really never was a field person, but very talented, had a lot of political connections in Congress. He ends up removing Hadley and several others. They bring in a guy by the name of Wayne Cone, C-O-N-E, who only lasts about 13 months. He's removed pretty quickly as well. And he's actually made the assistant superintendent in Rocky Mountain when he leaves Yosemite. So it was essentially a demotion for him. Certainly by stature it was. So, and then at the national level, the agency, this is sort of a wake-up call in many ways, not only in terms of law enforcement training, but also the fact that socially, these parks really could not be done in isolation. The Park Service started realizing that they needed to rely on their neighbors and work with their neighbors much more closely, from a management standpoint. And up until this time, many of these national park areas were pretty insular, if that's the right term. I mean, they were their own, they just took care of their own problems internally.
Right.
Really didn't do much to the outside. And I think that was a significant, I don't know about revelation, but certainly a significant aspect of the outcome of all of this. And then also they started putting rangers through a serious professional law enforcement training. And you've got a whole, you've got several hundred rangers around the country that are going to need to go to this school. And of course, they could only handle like 20 at a time. So there's quite a backlog. And ultimately, rangers from Yosemite and I think Sequoia were actually going to training in Clark County in Las Vegas.
Okay.
To their academy. So there are several spinoffs on the fallout from this incident. But I think socially and managerially was the most significant.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know what else. I mean, I could probably keep on going about that on this little tirade about what took place, but I'm not so sure I need to. Do you have some questions there?
Well, no, it would make sense. Basically, this is helpful for me to understand it. It would appear as though by 1970, what the National Park Service realized was that their staff was not trained in resource protection.
And crowd control and...
Well, yeah. I mean, that was now becoming a part of resource protection.
Yeah.
Which was, other people I've interviewed have talked about if they wore their weapon as a law enforcement officer, they would be called into the superintendent's office and say, and be told to hide their weapon, because what would the visitors think? And the ranger's reply was, well, I've got $10,000 cash in the car, going from the front entrance station to the bank, and I have no weapon, no weapon showing. That doesn't sound like it makes sense. So, again, this is increased visitation, increased stressors placed on the agency. And so it just makes sense that, to kind of play devil's advocate here a little bit of both sides, it would make sense that the park would then put more effort into law enforcement training.
Well, I mean, that was one of the major outcomes. And money was appropriated and or at least realigned to try to increase, you know, this training.
Okay.
Would you mind if I read a paragraph that I wrote for my book on Rangers?
Not at all.
About this incident?
Please.
And this is only, I don't know, one paragraph out of several pages worth. But it helps, I hope at least, sets the tone much better than I can ad lib about what was taking place.
So, okay.
So the paragraph begins, roving bands of half-naked hippies swaggered from one family tent to the next, panhandling money and food. Rock music blared, and despite extreme fire danger, fireworks exploded in the dark. Gatherings of juveniles shouted obscenities to the next tribal enclave, the second group trying to outdo the first in vulgarity and loudness. Vehicles raced throughout the valley. Loud mufflers thundered off the granite walls. A routine ranger campground patrol often resulted in rocks being thrown. Anyone in uniform was fair game for verbal assaults. To those officials out taking the park's pulse that night, the valley's most primitive, jungle-like atmosphere was surrealistic and nerve-wracking. More wine and drugs and the momentum for a nightmare kept building. So that's the sort of the night before this incident took place.
Okay.
That's how I phrased it. And that isn't much of an exaggeration. You know, I think that was, and the reason I say that is because this kind of atmosphere that I just read existed for the next several summers that I was there.
Okay.
And that first summer, when I was the night shift supervisor, in the summertime, this was an every night occurrence, just what I read. And the Rangers, and, you know, I had a number of, I don't know, five or six permanents and, I don't know, probably 15 or so seasonals at least, were responding to these, you know, to these incidents. And it wasn't like they had to fight their way in and fight their way out. And I don't mean to make it sound, you know, that dramatic. But there were many, many nights when it was scary. And it was like a, you know, sort of a jungle. You could hear the beat of the tom-toms in the background. And as I said, you know, ricocheting off the walls, the granite walls. It was a very interesting time.
So what did you do to get on top of it?
Well, I don't think I ever got on top of it, Tom.
Okay.
It just was a response, you know, one thing after another. And you would just live through it. And you would, the night shift, you know, there's a little staggering so that you have a little bit of an overlap. That would be, say from 4:30 till 12:30 or from 5 till 1, something like that. And I almost never, I mean, I bet you 4 days out of five, and I often work 7 days a week, but I bet you four nights out of those, I did not get home until the sun was coming up the next morning.
Okay.
And so I never got on top of it. What I did, and my, you know, the guys that were working with me and for me, we just sort of outlived it. We had to keep, you know, we'd go until nothing needed to be going to anymore, if that makes sense.
I mean, yeah,
We did not really manage stuff. But, you know, we had a presence. I tried, I think, in a small way, try to bring some temperament, if you will, to the people that were working with me. I'm certainly not going to pat myself on the back. I'm sure I made any number of mistakes. But, you know, when the sun would rise, you would come back to more of a normal day. And, you know, there'd be a lot of people, there'd be wall-to-wall people in the park, but they wouldn't be, it wouldn't be malevolent. I mean, there wouldn't be out, you know, people wouldn't be out, you know, trying to beat each other up at this point. But once it started getting dark, the heat of the day had been there. A lot of these younger people had been drinking or been taking drugs. Then, you know, the night would come around, and very often it would just be, not chaos is probably too strong a word, but it would be wall-to-wall incidents. We'd go from one first aid to one campground dispute to, you know, to a rescue, to just a loud camp, you know, a loud music in the campsite, two sites away, all that sort of thing. And it just was on and on and on. And, you know, from my perspective, being essentially an adrenaline freak, it was pretty exciting. It was also scary, and it was demanding, and it took a real toll on my family. Well, of course, I didn't have any kids at this point. Ultimately, it would take a toll on my family, more so, because my wife was working. And she understood, you know, what was taking place. And so she gave me a lot of slack on the fact that I wouldn't I wouldn't come home until the sun would be coming up.
Right, and you'd be coming in and she'd be going to work.
Well, it depended. I mean, sometimes she was working nights too. Because, we had, when she first started, when we first got there, I think pretty quickly she became a campground fee collector.
Okay.
So she could easily have been working at nights as well. The way the campgrounds were set up in those days, you couldn't go in. I mean, you could go into the campgrounds, but you couldn't take a site. The sites were occupied until like 3 or 4 in the afternoon, or maybe 2-ish in the afternoon. And so from that point on, then you'd be registering new occupants. Unless somebody had, you know, maybe had the campsite for 3 or 4 days or something.
Right.
So she was working quite a bit at nights as well, and she had access to a park radio, and she could hear what was taking place. But, you know, we didn't get paid overtime, and it was our, and I say our collectively, I mean my peers, men and women now, who are very good friends of mine to this day, our attitude was, we will work until we don't need to work anymore, if that makes sense. We didn't get paid for it, but we did not want our brother and sister rangers to be hung out. I mean, we felt like we needed to be out there helping them out. So,
boy, sounds like a great recipe for burnout.
Well, sure. Oh, yeah. And I, you know, it's going to be real easy for me to slip into the thing where, you know, the rangers and the staff today, well, I'm going to shut up on that one. Yes, burnout was would have been pretty potentially possible. We had a lot of deaths. In 73, we had 38 deaths in 1 year.
Now, this is visitor deaths or this is employee deaths?
No, this is, I'm sorry, visitor deaths.
Okay.
But, and they weren't all traumatic. Somebody had a heart attack or died of cancer. It was their time to go.
Right.
But mostly traumatic, car wrecks, cliffs, drownings, waterfalls.
Right. And that's hard on the staff that has to deal with distraught family members and body recovery, et cetera.
Yeah. And I did all of that as well. I've made a number of death notifications, you know, calling a family up on the phone. And, you know, it's much more sophisticated today, but in those days, that's what we had to do. We did not know enough. I say we collectively, either agency or even law enforcement professionally, we really didn't know much about calling the local police department and having them do something in person, which is sort of SOP these days. So I did a lot of that. I did a lot of body recoveries. I did a lot of EMS. At one time, I was probably the most advanced first aider at that in the in the park, and worked with the hospital, Dr. Wergler, Dr. Hendrickson, Dr. Laborde, the nurses, about a dozen, eight to a dozen nurses.
Hey, Butch.
Yes, sir.
This might be a good place to think about wrapping up part six, because I would like to learn more about the clinic, the hospital there, its relationship with the park, and hear your stories about Jim Wergler.
Okay.
So does that, would that make sense?
That's fine. That's fine with me.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this before we...
Did we talk about the riot per se now, really?
Yeah, I think the riot we pretty much covered, and now we're sort of heading off into your role in Yosemite for the 10 years you were there. And just the stressors on the park staff, that sounds like those stressors didn't go away after the riot. They were still there. The potential for burnout.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
So, okay,
but,
well.
Okay, go ahead and turn it off and I'll tell you.
Okay, well, so with that, then we'll conclude this part six oral history interview with Butch Farabee. Today is June 13th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Butch, thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.